and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Laquan McDonald's death sparked calls for change, where police reform efforts stand 10 years later. And inside the courtroom during Donald Trump's hush money trial, what one longtime journalist learned about the candidate and the state of America's democracy. Now to some of today's top stories. Chicago has less than $300 million in federal COVID relief funds remaining, according to an analysis by WTTW News. City officials have until 2026 to spend all of the federal funds Chicago got to repair the damage caused by the pandemic. However, the money must be budgeted by the end of this year. It comes as city leaders are facing a budget gap of $223 million this year and nearly a $1 billion deficit in 2025. Mayor Brandon Johnson is set to lay out his budget plan on Wednesday. The head of Chicago's Housing Authority is stepping down. CEO Tracy Scott announces her departure amid growing criticism the CHA has not done enough to address the city's affordable housing shortage. Scott will leave the agency on Friday after more than 4.5 years. Angela Herlock, chair of the CHA board, will serve as the agency's interim CEO. A spokesperson for Mayor Johnson did not immediately respond to a request for comment. A key city council committee is advancing Mayor Brandon Johnson's nominees to serve on the Regional Transportation Authority Board. The five nominees are Natasha Jenkins, Thomas Kodorak, Jerickson Medina, Dennis Mondero, and Nora K. Ryan. If confirmed by the full city council, the nominees would represent Chicago on the 16-member board for 5 years. The RTA, which oversees finances for the CTA, Metra, and PACE, is facing a $730 million deficit in 2026. The massive budget gap is sparking proposals to merge the Chicago area's three separate transit agencies. Officials say without a solution to the fiscal crisis, agencies will have no choice but to start planning for service cuts of up to 40%. Nearly 80 employees who work at a Pepsi production facility on the South Side might be out of a job at the end of the year. That's because PepsiCo says it's planning to stop operations at its only Chicago location near 51st and Halsted. Teamsters Local 727 says employees received the news this morning, but say the company's move is unlawful. In a statement, PepsiCo says the more than 60-year-old building has physical limitations and that the plan to shutter does in fact meet legal requirements. The union says it's hoping to meet with the company this week to discuss the move. Coming up, an update on the status of police reforms in Chicago. And Jeanette Young joins us right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Chicago this month marks the 10th year since the murder of teenager Laquan McDonald by police officer Jason Van Dyke. In the days and weeks after his death was brought to light, community members pushed for reforms. But advocates say efforts to hold the Chicago Police Department more accountable and to change the way officers interact with residents haven't shown much progress. Here now with more is Anjanette Young, founder of the I Am Her Foundation. Anjanette, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
So first, you know, we mentioned the 10-year anniversary of Laquan McDonald, the murder. It was last week. Earlier this year was the fifth anniversary, I hate to say anniversary, but the fifth year since your own trauma, which was, of course, the raid on your home. Have you seen CPD make improvements over these 5-10 years with regards to holding officers accountable?
Absolutely not. I've had an opportunity to speak on this matter with several officials around the city, and one of the things that I often share with them is that individuals like myself and other family members who are the ones that are being harmed by this, timing is an issue. Like, is with Laquan McDonald, it's been 10 years. For myself now, it's been 5 years. And yet we are still waiting for some tangible action from the consent decree.
And we know that the police department says, and the monitor, the federally appointed monitor, says that the department has is in full compliance with just 7%. I think it's a greater percentage with partial compliance and so on. And of course, the consent decree governs how the police department should make those reforms. And it came in the wake of Laquan's murder in 2017 and that entire scandal. You know, the small amount of progress that has been made, do you think that's making any difference?
Not at all. And I'm not really sure where they get the numbers from to say that there has been some progress at this point, because the community is not seeing any changes at all. When we think about Laquan McDonald and how he was murdered in the street and shot 16 times so aggressively by Chicago Police Department. And then yet, even just this year, we had Derek Reed. Right, and that young man was shot 96 times in 41 seconds. That's so excessive. And so to see police officers still harming the community the way they have, the community is not seeing any tangible change, although they're reporting in the data that there has been some change in the data.
After the raid on your home, of course, you called for reforms, specifically with the way police execute no-knock warrants. What would you like to see?
Right now, I'm very disappointed in our current administration with our current mayor, Brandon Johnson. When Lori Lightfoot was in office, she didn't do very much to make reforms. She did put an executive order in place. But for those of you who know what an executive order is, it's just a document that can be changed at any time. It's not set in stone. It's something that anyone can come and change the rules around the executive order. As well as we have not seen the police department make any reports about how the executive order is going or any other of the items that is in the consent decree. So I'm very disappointed at this time that when I chose to support Brandon Johnson as a candidate for mayor, he and I specifically talked about what that would mean for me and for me to publicly support him. And I shared with him my desire and my passion and my commitment to making change around the way the police interact with the black and brown community. And those things haven't happened yet. And Mayor Johnson is now in his second year, actually going into his third year. And nothing tangible has happened.
And you initially had faith in him.
I absolutely had faith in him when we talked about this. And I've had several conversations with him personally and his office about my desire to continue to push for police reform. And even this past year, I always speak on the anniversary of the raid. And he came out publicly and put a statement from his office saying that he still supported and was committed to working with me to make change. But as of right now, those things haven't happened.
There were efforts to get an ordinance through city council. It didn't make it. Why do you think progress has been so slow?
So the efforts in city council did not go forward because they're just people on the city council who are pro-police. They do not believe that the police did anything wrong the night that they were in my home. And they don't feel like the things that we were asking for in the ordinance were things that they could support. And so it kind of died in city council. And so that's why when Mayor Johnson was a candidate, I went directly to him to say, okay, when you become mayor, we don't need a majority vote in city council. These are things that you could push yourself. And he was committed to it at that time, but right now those things haven't happened.
And of course, anybody, like, just to remind our viewers, you know, anybody who's seen the video from the raid on your home, which was brought to light by our colleagues at CBS2, anybody watching would have had a visceral reaction to what you were experiencing and what you were going through, being, you know, your home is basically not barricaded, but the officers busted through your door,
yeah,
basically, while you were changing clothes and you know, went around your apartment for a while without helping you and getting you something to cover yourself up as you were pleading with them, letting them know that they had the wrong home.
Correct.
Do you think that, you know, the consent decree expanding to include the warrant searches, do you think that's helped or hurt your efforts?
I don't think either. So it's a positive that it was added into this consent decree. However, it's a negative if we never if we never hold a consent decree to tangible outcomes. And as of right now, the consent decree is just a piece of paper because there are no tangible outcomes that has been produced to the public to say that the consent decree is a good thing.
You've also been in touch with CPD Superintendent Larry Snelling. He's been on the job for just over a year. Do you have faith in his ability to make change on this?
So, yes, I've had personal conversations with Superintendent Snelling, and he verbalizes a commitment to work with me on what it would look like to hold the officers accountable. One of the specific questions I asked him is, by him being the head of the police department, where's his commitment in whatever the mayor and I could come to an agreement on, because we know that he would have to have a commitment in order for his officers to then actually follow through on the things that we put in place. And so he reported a commitment to work with me on those things. However, that meeting with him was early spring, so before the DNC, and we all agreed that we needed to let the DNC, go past because there was so much going on, and that we were going to meet back at the table. However, at this time, I've asked for meetings, and those meetings haven't happened at this time.
You have a background in social work. You have since started the I Am Her Foundation, you said, because you saw the parallels between your story and that of Breonna Taylor, who was also killed by police in her apartment in Kentucky. What were the parallels that you saw?
So the way Breonna Taylor was murdered in her home, the way the police came to her home and kicked the door in, and the way they shot up her home, I felt that same parallel when what had happened in my home. And what was so disheartening for me is that my home had been raided 13 months prior to Breonna Taylor, and no one had really heard of my story. And it wasn't because I wasn't telling my story, it was because we didn't have body cam footage, so no one was really taking my story seriously. And that's a lot to be said about how media reports as well. So they didn't have a video to show, so nobody really took my story that seriously. However, when I saw the Breonna Taylor story, I was like, that just happened to me last year. And so I started wearing a T-shirt with Breonna Taylor's face on it. So when I did start to make some public speakings and was being able to get in front of the public, I wore a T-shirt and it just said, I am her. Because I wanted people to know that the very thing that happened to Breonna Taylor had happened to me as well.
Did you think your story could have gone differently?
I totally think my story could have gone differently. If anybody that have followed it from the very beginning, it happened in February of 19. We initially did a story in November of 19. We didn't have body cam footage at that time. And so the story really didn't go very well, far. And so I had gone all of these months, agonizing and fighting with the city through my legal team to get some traction on my story. And it's unfortunate that it wasn't until we got the video in December of 20 that anyone really paid attention to what had happened to me.
And Jeanette, how would you say your life has changed since this raid?
Everything about my life has changed. My ability to trust in our police department system has completely changed. The work that I do as a social worker has changed. Before this raid, I was a social worker that primarily did direct practice, working with families around mental health and direct services. And now my work is more of advocacy and policy change. So this and the way I live my life and who I allow in my personal circle, all of those things have changed. My life would never be the same as it was before this.
Of course, there's the trauma that you experienced then that I imagine has an impact, but you're turning your pain into purpose. We've got just a few seconds left. Tell me about the work that the I Am Her Foundation does.
So the purpose of the I Am Her Foundation is to provide resource, reduce barriers, and provide resource to therapy. I understand that during my time that going to therapy was a key component to my healing journey after the trauma. And so I want to be able to give back to others who have those same experiences. We understand that in the Black community that access to therapy is a huge barrier for many people. And so with my I Am Her Foundation, I want to be
sure
able
folks
to...
are able to get access to that with and the support that they need, because not everybody can afford it.
Absolutely.
Either. Okay. And Jeanette Young, thank you so much of the I Am Her Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And up next, Amanda Vinicky with a front row seat to history as a journalist takes us inside the courtroom for Trump's hush money trial. Stay with us.
America has a big and historic choice to make. Who will be the next president? The first woman or the first convicted felon? Earlier this year, author Jonathan Alter, who grew up in Chicago, was among a small group of journalists in the courtroom for former President Donald Trump's conviction for illegally concealing hush money payments to an adult film star. Alter wrote a book on it called American Reckoning, Inside Trump's Trial and My Own. And he joins us now with more. Jonathan, thanks so much. Now, you grew up again in Chicago. This is a blue block, but really much of Illinois otherwise, and of course we've got battleground states as our neighbors, heavily Republican. So outside of the candidates themselves, do you feel like we're at a point in America where there is a divide, and is there a risk of it becoming irreparable?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but we're clearly tremendously divided, and this is a national moment of truth. This is the most significant election, I would argue, since another Illinois native, Abraham Lincoln, ran for re-election in 1864. That's how big the stakes are. It's really about what kind of country do we want to be. When you have Donald Trump's former chief of staff, retired general, and his former top military commander, the chair of the Joint Chiefs, both saying he is a fascist who does not believe in our system of government. And he is this close to going back to the presidency, and that's what they learned from when he was there the last time. This is a crisis. This is an American crisis. So the question becomes, what do all of us do about it? And in the book, in addition to covering the trial, I write about when Franklin Roosevelt was president, and he had people at the depths of the Depression hang a decal in their window and had a blue eagle on it, and it said underneath, "We do our part." So what is each of our part? So for me, it's bearing witness. It's writing. That's what I can do. Other people, they can do all kinds of things beyond just voting. They can use these call tools to call into battleground states from the comfort of their own home. They can go over the border into Wisconsin and help get out the vote. There's a lot that people can do. They need to stop wringing hands and start ringing doorbells to save our republic.
You know, I think that, and you write in your book as well, that, and I guess this is to your point, that American reckoning for you, it's a double meeting. It is the reckoning of Trump, but your own reckoning with what it means to be an American. And you write that you believe that there's an assault on your assumption that most Americans have common sense. So is this beyond partisanship?
Oh, it's way beyond partisanship. I mean, this is not a, it shouldn't be about, you know, whether you want taxes to go up for the wealthy or down for whatever. Those are minor issues compared to our system of government. I mean, we have a candidate, Donald Trump, who wants to use the military or the National Guard against American citizens.
Then why do we have about half the country behind him?
Well, this is the great puzzle that I try to sort through in the book, and I think that my reaction to what's happened in this country and to Trump's criminality, I think it patterns the reaction of a lot of people out there, not just Democrats, by the way. Look at Liz Cheney. You know, there's quite a number of Republicans, including many conservative Republicans, who don't believe Trump is a conservative. You know, he's busting the budget, he's a protectionist. But it, also, he just, he doesn't represent American values of freedom and democracy. He wants to be a strong man. He wants to be an American Putin. So we have to ask ourselves, what do we do? Like, how do we respond?
So let's step back there, because you were one of the few people that really had a window into this trial. You got close to him. What did you learn during the trial that most Americans don't know and didn't have the opportunity to see because there were not cameras in the courtroom?
The extent of his criminality. He, you know, he was guilty on 34 counts. It was 34 counts of the same offense. But during the trial, we saw a picture of a criminal operation. And, you know, they basically were undertaking a conspiracy to change the 2016 election. Everybody knows that he tried to stage a coup to overturn the results of the 2020 election. But this trial was about the 2016 election. I barely scratched the surface in the New York Times of the drama of this trial. Like, just imagine seeing this jury foreperson go guilty, guilty, guilty 34 times. And then I see Donald Trump. He looks like he's been punched in the gut before he puts on his game face for the cameras. And witnessing all of this, and Amanda, I've witnessed a lot of stories in 40 years in journalism. This was a hugely dramatic moment. And so I try to take the readers into the courtroom and really paint a picture of what this was like, and a very entertaining trial as well.
Your story and sort of your career is also connected to your mother, who broke barriers in Cook County politics. And of course, this is a potentially historic election with the chance to see the first woman elected president of the United States. Now, let's look at a clip of a woman candidate. Let's see who it is in Cook County, talking about the importance of representation. This was from 1990.
I think it's important for our political establishment and our elected officials to reflect our society. And when we can put up an all-man ticket, completely men, sheriff, state's attorney, president of the county board, assessor, all men, we're not reflecting our society. Now, there are women who are qualified to run for higher office, and I believe I'm one of those, and I think that it's important for men and women to understand that we have to have a representative government, and a representative means young and old and black and white and men and women, and presenting a ticket without any women on it is a disgrace, I think, in 1990.
There, of course, is your very own mother.
Bring a tear to my eye, Amanda.
What did you learn from her about sort of the travails of breaking gender barriers, and what does that have for this race now?
Right, so just to be accurate, she lost that race for County Cook.
Yes, that one. She had won previously.
18 years earlier, in 1972, she became the first woman elected to office in Cook County, commissioner of the
what's now
called the Water Reclamation District, and she broke barriers. I kind of thought of her as like the Jackie Robinson of gender politics in Chicago. But, you know, what I learned from her, and she learned from a very brief meeting with Eleanor Roosevelt when she was in college, is that you have to think about how you're going to try to make a better world, and that it's not enough to just, you know, sit it out. And sure, you have other things that you can do, and people are very busy, but they have to take some time trying to work for social progress. And at least sometime right now, if she were alive, she would be saying it's all hands on deck to try to save our democracy.
Now, in your book briefly as well, speaking of another powerful woman, Nancy Pelosi, you had the opportunity to really learn from her role in getting, Vice President Harris to be the Democratic Party nominee.
The story that I tell in this book, which is all new, does not come directly from her, but it comes from somebody very close to her and somebody very close to Joe Biden. And it tells what I think is a very dramatic and historically important story of how she maneuvered Joe Biden off the ticket this past summer. And she did so with great skill. It was a very deft operation. At first, she thought that the men, Schumer, you know, Jeffries, Clinton, Obama, that they were kind of MIA, that the women had more courage to step forward and do what the Democratic Party needed, which was to get a candidate who could win. And she achieved that. It was very tough going, and it cost her her 40-year friendship with Joe Biden. If it wasn't for COVID, I report for the first time in this book, Joe Biden would probably be the nominee today. COVID, I was told by somebody very close to him, was the last straw, and he was ready to play out the clock and stay on the ticket.
Sick.
He really did not want to bow out.
We will leave it there. Thank you so much once again. That is Jonathan Alter, the book called American Reckoning, Inside Trump's Trial and My Own. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
And that's our show for this Monday night. Be sure to check out our WTTW News Voter Guide. It is a one-stop shop for everything you need to know before voting. You'll find candidate profiles and questionnaires, as well as key dates to know and how to find out if you're registered to vote. It is all at WTTW.com/voter guide. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Election Day is a week away. Our Spotlight Politics team on what you should know before you cast your ballot. And a Hail Mary heartbreaker aside, a mid-season look at where the Chicago Bears stand. Oh, there it is right there. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its 20 attorneys recognized in the 2025 edition of the Best Lawyers in America.